This evening's forum is called Who Lives, Who Dies. It's a follow-up to a videotape that happened earlier today that several of us watched. And if you weren't able to see it, don't worry. It's not a prerequisite. Before we get any further into some conversation together, I'd like us to start out with a little conversation in prayer to God and to help us seek guidance in this time together. Join with me in prayer. Gracious and loving God, we ask your presence with us in these next several minutes. Be present with us as we try to clarify some important things, to learn from one another. But most importantly, be present to us so that we might be present to one another, forming a community of believers at this very moment in time. Help us to be open to one another and to be open to our own vulnerability. Gracious God, in your mercy, we ask all this in your name. Amen. If you have problems hearing me, please raise your hand, wave, do something. I often am told that my voice doesn't carry, so just, I'm not offended in the least by that. So just let me know. The next thing I'd like to do is just, I'd like to set up a few house rules for the next hour. There aren't too many rules here at Holden Village, but I'd like to set up a few for the next hour at least. And I think you'll agree to them. They're pretty open-ended. I want you to know that we're here, the purpose of this session is for a free and open exchange of ideas and opinions. And I hope that you are make yourself available to the variety of opinions and ideas that you'll hear here. And that we are an accepting community of something that might be a little bit different or hard to understand. We're not here to make a decision, so don't worry about coming to consensus on anything. We're here just to hear one another and to listen. I will act as the moderator. If you have something to say, I'm the person you need to kind of whistle at, wink at, do something. And I'll try to keep track of who needs and wants to talk. If I'm not noticing you, be louder or more boisterous. I will also act as the timekeeper. We will end at 10 o'clock, and I'll make sure that happens. And then I'd also ask that it tell you that it's very important that you speak for yourself. Use that little word I as frequently as possible. I think, I feel, I want, whatever it is. But make sure that you're speaking for yourself and to try to speak briefly and with clarity so that your idea can be understood. And we'd like to have as many people have the opportunity to speak as possible. So if you've had a couple of chances, I may not call on you right away, okay? Are there other house rules other people would like to bring up?
Talk loudly.
Thank you. Repeat for one. I'll try to do that. Repeat questions. Anything else? Okay. We'll be on our way then. The session, as I said, is called Who Lives, Who Dies, and I stole that title. I figure plagiarism is the highest form of compliment, as long as you tell who it belongs to. This was the name of a program that was on public television this spring, and we viewed that earlier today, several of us. The procedure for the evening that we're going to follow is I have asked three individuals who were at the session this afternoon if they would respond to the film that we saw, and it was basically about healthcare systems and some of the questions that we're having today because of technology. They will be doing a 2 or 3 minute commentary of their own personal response to the film or personal reactions to some things that they understand in their lives or from their experience, and then we'll open it up to the rest of folks for your similar comments or questions. I've put a few questions on the board up here that came to my mind as the film went on today. And I put so many up there so that maybe one of them hits you or two of them hits you, you know, so that it asks the question that's important to you. I'm just going to read them, and I'm sorry the blue pen was running out of ink. In the healthcare system, how are our scarce resources distributed? That was a main question that we've been looking at. When should treatment or treatments end? When should they be stopped? How important are the gains that we get to technology in our healthcare system? Can we continue to be so idealistic? It's a question straight from the film today asked by one of the physicians. What about those with self-inflicted disease, for example, liver problems because of alcoholism, or smoking problems because of smoking, and those sorts of things? What is a fair way of rationing healthcare, rationing donor organs? When does the patient have the right to decide? And then this is not really a question, but this is basically the whole issue that I've been thinking about. The conflict between those who do not want care, medical treatment, versus those who need it. Where does the money go? So those are some of the questions I have before me in my mind. Maybe one or more of them fit for you folks. I want to thank the three folks who came forward today and said they'd be willing to comment. There are three of them who volunteered. I'm just going to ask them to speak. And I didn't give them an outline or anything, so they're just speaking from their heart or guts or whatever. Alan Shelton is a physician and is studying public health, right? Is that what you're studying it right now? And if you want to say anything else about yourself and why you came forward, go ahead. Why don't you respond first?
I've worked 4 years now with the Puyallup Indian Tribe in Tacoma. So my career in medicine has essentially been with the indigent. I also work at a clinic at St. Leo's Church, neighborhood clinic for those who cannot afford health care.
And a little louder would help.
Sorry. My interest in public health is essentially the issue that was presented today, and that is the decreasing access to health care by the poor in our country. So I really enjoyed the film. It was pointed out on many different levels and in different areas how those who are poor are left with fewer choices, and how, on the other hand, those with resources are using incredible amounts of our resources, even though they are often a lost cause. Thousands and thousands of dollars are spent in the last few days of one's life in the intensive care, and so on. I guess I could respond on many different levels to the film, but one thing that sort of got my attention is one fellow who nearly died, and it didn't really say for sure what his condition was in terms of prognosis, but it didn't sound very good. He had been transferred from one hospital because he was unable to pay before they had made a diagnosis, and he had ended up having a cerebral bleed from an aneurysm. And in commenting on that, the brother or a relative of his was concerned with the doctor who had treated him at the initial hospital. And I understand his concern about that physician. And that physician, in transferring that patient, I can't say that was an honorable thing to do. However, the issue there is much more than one physician who is not strong enough to go against maybe his hospital policy. And that's the issue that is essentially goes to the policymakers all the way up to our government, who has decided that less and less healthcare dollars can be spent in preventive care and for the poor, and more healthcare must be bought and obtained by those who have insurance. When you have a situation like that, you get more and more preventive diseases not being prevented. And the other thing that was shown was all the money spent in the neonatal intensive care units for prematurely born babies. Many of these babies end up being million-dollar babies in the intensive care units and never can have the hope of a normal life, all of which could have been prevented by simple prenatal care. And we just, as a country, have not been willing to provide prenatal care to our poor. And that seems to me to be very immoral. And it's incredible enough that in Washington, D.C., our level of infant mortality is essentially that of a third world nation. And the United States, a country with all the money and medical expertise that we have, ranks 20th in infant mortality. And the reason for that is we do not provide prenatal care to our poor people. And that if you draw a graph of the prenatal care that's been provided 6 years ago or so, it changed from a direction of our infant mortality going down, and our infant mortality has steadily increased in the last 6 years, and that is directly a result of our government's policy in health care.
Okay. Here's some more from you, I'm sure. Another person who volunteered to respond or react was Louise Robertson. Louise describes herself to me as a nurse and a taxpayer.
I'm going to talk to you as a taxpayer. I'll be crass and commercial. The video made me angry all over again at the way my tax money is being spent. In nursing, I saw, as the doctor did, babies who were kept alive, babies with all kinds of things wrong with them, and I knew they weren't going to live, but they were kept alive anyway at huge expense. Meanwhile, other babies were born prematurely or born with a low birth weight. If a baby's brain isn't big enough, he's born retarded, and I, as a taxpayer, will pay for his special ed all his life. I will pay for his special workshop all his life, and I don't like my tax money being spent that way. I would like to see my tax money spent providing food for all the thousands of hungry children rather than keeping alive with a heart transplant one man who's already lived 65 years. That's what I would like to see happen. It makes me so angry. I would like to take all the people in charge and I'm not being represented with my tax money. It's taxation without representation, so I'd like to throw them all in the Boston Harbor along with the tea, only I can't find anybody in charge. I think the technology is in charge. I think I'll wake up sometime and find a computer sitting in the White House. And I don't like it, and I'm frustrated. And I'm hoping to hear that somebody's planning something for a more equitable and honorable way to take care of people than to just let it happen by itself and happen all wrong with me paying for it.
Thank you, Louise. Louise has also shown us that, been a good example here. I'm inviting people to share feelings as well as personal experience, so please make sure that you feel open to do that. The third volunteer was Don Bouts, who has been and will be again a hospice administrator and is a retired pastor.
The film we saw today, Who Lives and Who Dies, is the second one I've seen. The other one I saw was Who Lives, Who Dies, and Who Decides, which I think is the biggest question that we have to face. In Florida, where I've been with hospice care as the pastoral care minister, we have the third highest AIDS people as far as that disease is concerned in the country. We right next to New York City and San Francisco. And it's a matter of not only money to take care of these people, many of whom are not without any support from their families, from the community itself, in providing a place for them. And it's also a matter of the courts having the final decision as to what goes on in this whole field. We had a man whose wife was ill with Alzheimer's disease, and he could no longer see her suffering. So he took a gun and shot her. And Mr. Gilbert is now in jail. And we're supporting the fact that he is in jail and has committed this crime. As far as the courts are concerned, if a person has a living will, which is recognized, and the doctors recognize it at the time, they don't have to be given these kinds of supports that we saw in the film today. But there still is a problem with people who are in nursing homes or in adult congregate living facilities. And if they are so-called vegetables, just living by being force-fed, if they are denied that forced feeding, then the nursing home or the ACLF loses its license. So the courts have to decide something of that nature at the present time. We had a person in South Florida whose husband had Alzheimer's and who was being force-fed in a nursing home. And she went to court in order to get the ability to be able to feed him other than by the tubes and those other measures. And so she is now feeding him and taking the time which is necessary to do that. But she couldn't keep him in this institution without the courts having decided that this was the right thing to do. So there are many issues which we're facing in this whole matter, and AARP, of which I happen to be the religious liaison, says that health care is progressing at such a rate that we cannot afford it if we keep on going in the way we've gone in these last 5 years.
Thanks. Any responses to the questions, to the comments that have been surfaced to you? Go ahead.
Well, I'm a believer, I guess, in our system of government. But the question has come up, who pays for this? And I don't believe that it should be a federally run or a federally taxed program, personally. I think the federal government monitors much too many things, as it is these days. It should be a locally run program. Let's focus on the state level for once. The idea that the federal government should take care of us is just a little over 50 years old, that concept is. And I think it's already proven that it's not going to work. The federal government is a huge machine that doesn't take the time to look at the little person, you know. I guess my point is, wouldn't the programs, the health programs, the money you spend, would you rather give it in taxation, have your taxes increased in order to cover these costs? Would you rather do it on the local level, on the state level, have your state taxes raised? Or would you rather be a society that gave to charity? You know, is it the federal government's fault that there's no money for this, or is it the society's fault as a whole? You know, we're not giving to charity. You know, we're not, you don't see charity hospitals like there used to be, you know, where people are taken care of. I don't believe it's all, you know, coming down from Uncle Sam and pouring on down. I think that a lot of it needs to be initiated at the local level. I don't think a person who lives in Montana or North Dakota should have to suffer the burden of taking care of the AIDS victims or the patients in New York City. I think that's taxation without representation. Because if you tax the country as a whole, whereas each state, if they took care of their own people and you monitored it on a state level, I think would be much more effective and much more personal. Mm-hmm. And it could deal with that specific area in the country, you know, a lot, I guess, more in depth. And as far as the taxation without representation, I would, you know, the question brought up over here, I would ask, when was the last time you spoke to a representative or congressman that you vote for?
I write lots of letters.
Okay, so then you do have representation in Washington.
But nothing happens.
Well, then that's time to change your representation. But you still have representation, nevertheless, you know. And that's why Washington isn't the place to monitor a health program like this. It should be your state legislator, your state senator, you know, your local people that should be, you know, looking out for you.
What you said that when the government trying to take care of people, it doesn't work. I don't see that. It hasn't been proven that it doesn't work, because there's plenty of countries, such as Canada, where I'm from, where nobody pays, well, everybody pays through taxes for Medicare, but you don't go to a hospital and pay. Whether you're a millionaire or whether you have no money at all, you go into a hospital or you go to a doctor's office and it's paid for, no matter what the expense, whether you have a $500,000 operation to be done or whether you have to get some $90 for a cold or whatever. And it works very well.
Okay, the point is that everyone pays through taxation. Whereas in this country, everyone wants, but no one wants to give. I want free medical services for myself and my family, but I don't want to pay more taxes. No one here does, right? I mean, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe some people do want their taxes raised in order to,
you know. Why don't we go to response? Do you want to respond?
Oh, well, I disagree. I'm very willing to pay more taxes so that everybody has an equal opportunity to access the healthcare system and have equal healthcare attention.
Okay.
Anybody else have a response? I heard
saw lots of
nods. Sherry?
Yeah, I guess I do feel a burden for other people in the country and other people in the world, sort of as a Christian. And I wouldn't mind my taxes being spent on medical care rather than on a huge military buildup, for example. I think that other countries do have much more effective ways of treating people. I think it's pretty inhumane to refuse medical care to anyone based on intelligence level. I think if we start refusing medical care to mainly retarded, we start losing our reverence for life. It starts to become less sacred. So I really take issue with that.
Upstairs there's a couple.
Okay, whoever, green. I just wanted to say that there's only one other nation in this world that does not have some kind of a national health care system, and that nation is South Africa.
And did you have to know I was pointing?
Okay. I think everyone here would assume that it would be reasonable if there is a community wherein a member of a community was sick and they needed, say, a $100,000 operation, they obviously can't afford it. Everyone would look at that community, and if everyone chipped in as much as they could and paid for the operation, that would be a good thing. That, you know, that wouldn't by no means be an evil thing or be an unjust thing or be an unfair burden. But through taxation and through a government system, you're merely guaranteeing that the community does help, that it is a collective effort, that this burden isn't placed on one individual. And it's hard to say that, it's easy to say when we're sitting here in good health and we're all fairly well-to-do, like enough to afford health insurance or whatever. It's easy to say, well, I don't want to pay for that person's health problem or whatever, but if you can switch situations wherein you've got more immediate concerns than going all the way downtown to get health insurance, if you can even afford it.
I know, referring to this young man's statement about being a state level thing. Do you live in Montana?
No, I don't.
Okay, well, whatever. But I don't see how that could possibly work, because people who live on either coast or on the southern border are getting all the people in, the Haitians, the South Americans, the Mexicans, you know, they're just coming in. So they're settling in Florida and Georgia and all along the coastline and the borders, you know, and so the people that live there, by that same token, why should they support all this and leave the guys in the middle of the United States scot-free? I mean, that's not fair either.
Okay, I guess my point is, who here thinks that the federal government is equipped to run a program of that magnitude? Or is responsible enough to run a program of that magnitude? Or whatever, you know, I mean, that could actually run it?
Well, I work for the Social Security Administration, and part of our agency runs Medicare, and I don't want to downplay the agency, but we do what we can, and I feel that we're doing a good job.
Right, but what we're talking about is a lot larger than just Medicare. You know, we're talking about the entire...
Go ahead.
Did you
want to
respond?
No.
Well, I just suggest the federal government can do admirably well the funding of a national health care program. I mean, the national government does one thing very well. It collects taxes. And it makes transfer payments from those who have to those who have not. And the United States does that supremely well. I mean, Americans are great taxpayers. We're the best in the world. So the answer to your question is yes, in terms of funding a national health care system, the federal government should do it. Now, distributing the health care, that's another question. But, you know, that clinic in Montana may be the best place to take care of someone who is ill in Montana. But it might be the national government that makes sure there is a clinic in Montana.
Any other responses to that issue or another issue that's surfaced in your mind? Go ahead.
Well, something that surfaced in my mind when I looked at the questions half an hour ago, what about those with self-inflicted disease? One of my pet peeves are people who have head injuries from riding a motorcycle without a helmet. They're allowed to make their own choice, but it's the burden of the public who deals with the ones who don't have insurance and who suffer the consequences of not wearing a helmet and then being involved in an accident.
Betty, just to ask as long as we've got on this national thing, if somebody here perhaps has the information of what national programs we have. We have the Veterans Hospitals, I know they're national. We have the National Health Institute, isn't it? Bethesda, that is disease control, preventive medicine, and things that exist today that are operating and doing the job that had to be done at that level. Now, I don't have all that. Somebody has.
Did everybody hear the question?
No. If someone could give the information, programs we have, like the Veterans Hospital that are nationally operated, the National Health Program, Preventive Disease Control Institute in Washington,
that are governmental,
that are running, that are.
Anybody got any information on that? Governmental programs that are available.
Well, I think there's no doubt that we do have federal programs and also state programs which are in the healthcare system. But when we compare what the United States spends as a part of its gross national product for healthcare, we actually spend more than Canada does. And yet we don't have the kind of healthcare which is available in Canada. We are short as far as taking care of our health care needs, although we as a nation spend more than Canada does itself. So there's something wrong there.
I think.
Do we have more indigent than Canada, or probably a larger population than Canada does?
No, I'm talking about the percentage of our gross national product. not the amount, but the percent.
A great reason for that, I think, is the point that the gentleman over there brought up about the prevention, about the poor getting ready access to it. I mean, and we have inoculations in the schools. We have health care that's directly administered to the schools. And so right there, that makes a big difference. And also, it's a lot more readily accessible when you don't have to go down and put down a certain amount of money, or you don't have to have health insurance. So things are nipped in the bud, and you don't have these as many of these million-dollar babies, which end up spending their lives institutionalized.
Go ahead. That makes me think of a point that was made today in the video, is that the federal government saves $10 for every dollar spent on immunization programs. In other words, every dollar they spend on immunizations, they're saving $10 in potential future care for people who come down with the diseases that they're preventing.
Back here.
I think we haven't dealt with the poor who can't measure up here or there and everything. All these things we're talking about, are they available for the poor, the people that don't have money? I understand there's all sorts of people who are wandering the streets that have no homes. I live near Cincinnati, and this is in the paper all the time. People who don't even try to get into homes because there's no room. Is all this available to them?
Third question. Did people hear her question? What's available to the homeless and to the poor is her question. Anybody want to respond?
I don't know what it's like any place else, but in Seattle, I work for a social service agency. And the very poor, yes,
little louder, please.
The very poor in Seattle are well taken care of. It's the middle class who fall between the cracks are retired people who are living on very minimum income that are not getting by on medical bills and are not receiving the attention they need.
Alan, did you have something you wanted to say?
Well, you know, in Canada, the woman is pregnant, she gets prenatal care no matter how much money she has or doesn't have, and that situation is not in the United States. And one program we did have was WIC, Women, Infants, and Children, which was a very efficient program for the dollar spent in providing food for women who were pregnant or infants. You could prevent 3 to 5 times that in money spent treating the resultant disease. But Washington State, like most states, has cut way back on the WIC funding because of the federal funding for that program. I know that one thing we worked on last year in our church was Bread for the World had a drive to try and improve that funding. That's just an example of one program that tried to do some preventive work. Our healthcare dollars just go inefficiently spent on high intensity care for people that are dying, and not spent in preventing those issues. And I think it would, if we could just somehow emphasize prevention a little more, I think we'd do a lot better.
Do you want to respond? 2 minutes ago.
Well, so much of this, the story seems to emphasize various areas, and it seems to be different depending on where you live. A lot of the federal medical dollar is sent back to the states and to the counties, and they're administered by those counties. So a lot of us happen to be from Minneapolis, and our county is probably one of the best in the United States concerning the administration of medical care, prenatal care. Doesn't matter what your economic situation is, you're going to get care. And we find people come from all over the country and come to our cold climate because of those sorts of programs. And doctors and hospitals and everything will provide this care because they're going to be paid for their services. That's just a fact. The facts are.
The cold kills the germs, right?
Well, I'm from Minneapolis also, and the point is, that's because the people there want it. You know what I mean? We wanted it that way. The same with Washington State having or not having this program, this prenatal program. If the people in the state of Washington want it bad enough, the people in the state of Washington will pay their state taxes and get their state representatives wound up enough to have a program put in place like that. You know, that's why I'm talking, because I'm from Minneapolis and I'm used to health care the way it is there, and I know that that's because the people there wanted it and fought for it to be like that.
Sherry? I think the problem with that is that the people that probably want it and need it the most really don't have the power to get it. And I think something that's nice about a federal system as opposed to a state system is that states go through different levels of prosperity. For example, the South may be prosperous while the North may not be. So we can kind of cover each other. I'm from Texas, I know that very well. So I think it's really nice. A federal system would be better so that we can help each other out in the United States.
Part of the problem with the federal government programs like Medicare, Medicaid, is that they use federal money, but they're administered by the states. In Florida, for instance, we don't do as good a job with Medicare as they do in maybe Minnesota. That's the fault of our state legislature. On the other hand, we do have a program for elderly called Community Care for the Elderly, which is a state program, which not too many other states have, which is in addition to Medicare and Medicaid. So that even the guidelines which are set up by the federal government are not always followed through by the states themselves. So that you have to look at the total picture. In all the conferences I've gone to on this subject, they have pointed out that it's not just a government program. It has to be a partnership with individuals, having insurance for long-term care, with business and industry, as far as supporting health care needs of their workers are concerned, as well as the federal government and the state government.
It just seems to me that a lot of what we're talking about is a crisis, if you will, in our healthcare system, in our medical system. And a question that comes to my mind is wondering why the medical schools still, to my knowledge anyway, spend no time whatsoever in preventive medicine. Preventive medicine is not a focus. The focus of medicine is on treating diseases, and it's become very profitable to treat cancer and heart disease and these things. There's a lot of money at stake. There's a lot of vested interest now surrounding the kinds of diseases that as a culture we're famous for. Nobody wants to talk about changing your diet or taking vitamins or any of the kinds of preventative things that people could do to maybe make some changes for themselves. And I just wonder what part the AMA plays in this. I wonder why there isn't more of a national outcry, if you will, for doctors to become more knowledgeable in preventive medicine, to begin to educate their patients more, to begin to
She had a lot of good ideas, but we can't hear too well.
Well, she couldn't hear you. Can you summarize in one sentence or two? Basically, you were saying is that why don't we put more effort and money into preventive measures, teaching people prevention?
Yes, but I think that a lot of the fault lies with the AMA and the medical profession.
How about insurance? Insurance companies, aren't they just starting to pay for preventive care? Used to be you had to be sick before they pay for anything. And since medical care is mostly paid for by insurance these days, that we have to get to the insurance companies too.
I think, you know, what happens in the world is what gets paid to happen. And a doctor who spends a lot of time helping a client, say, stop smoking or lower his cholesterol level, cannot earn as much money as when he takes out his appendix. In other words, what gets done is what's paid to get done. And what we're not yet clear on is medical care a social good that we should all pay for, or is medical care a private good, which each person should buy as much of it as he or she possibly can? And because we have that mixed system, we have medical care which, as a private good, can be very expensive, and there are some who can pay for it. On the other hand, when we turn that system over and say, well, now it's a public good, we're never going to be able to give everyone a heart transplant, a liver transplant. So we're going to have this mixed system where we're going to have highly expensive care that a few people can treat as a private good and pay for out of their own money. And on the other hand, we're going to have to look at health care as a public good, but it won't be the same level of care.
Well, my point was that...
We can't afford it.
You know, my point was that in focusing more on preventative medicine, that there would be less need for the high-tech, tremendously expensive medical procedures. There would be less need for that. And more people would get better general medical care.
But you're going to have to pay a doctor $100,000 a year to do preventive medical care.
I'm talking about a moral interest.
This is the system we live in.
Well, is this the system we want to continue?
Do you want to say something more, Anne? Dick, you want to say more?
No.
Up here?
I just want to make the point that only what gets done is what gets paid for.
I agree.
Back here, this is okay.
I've spent a lot of time this summer in doctor's offices and hospitals, and my doctors, there were four of them involved, and all were practicing preventative medicine. Mm-hmm. They were concerned about my diet, they were concerned about exercise and all of that. And so the doctors that I deal with are concerned with that as much as taking care of the problem at hand.
Well, excuse me.
Okay.
One of the things that this video today said to me was it pointed out the needs of preventive care, especially for prenatal care, and why people weren't getting it because there was no money, which we've talked about. But what it also brought up is those people that are, and an example mentioned earlier with motorcycle helmets, 39-year-old guy in 1983 who had been in a car accident, was a vegetable, was never going to recover, and the tremendous amount of money, and I can't remember the dollar amount, maybe one of you can, being spent to keep this guy living. And all that money could possibly go for prenatal care. And I think that's the issue that I'll focus of all your questions we haven't even touched on.
Okay. I wanted to point out that we have about 15 minutes, so if there is something that we haven't talked, we focused a lot on the government here. If there's something you want said, we have 15 minutes to do it.
I guess I'm not trying to sound ignorant here, but why is it so expensive? I mean, what is it? I mean, to run the machine is costing electricity, right? And the nurses say they get paid $12 an hour or something, right? I mean, I don't know why it has to cost like $300,000 to have a transplant. I mean, it's just a doctor putting in, granted, a lot of time, but I don't. And I understand like transporting and having all the machines going and everything, But, I mean, why is it so expensive? I mean, that just sounds absolutely horrendous. Just to have, like, maybe, say, an 8-hour operation. You know what I mean? If granted to all the time involved and afterwards and all that kind of stuff, but.
Anybody want to respond to that?
I think she was right. She's not very well informed.
Okay, can you?
Well, I'm not, that's why I'm asking.
Do you have some information for her, or how should I find it?
Well, I can't quote any numbers. Yeah, you got to read and study things like that to get them, but you take something like, what's this machine that you...
CAT scan.
A CAT scan machine. Boy, that costs a bundle. Somebody's got to pay for it if they're going to use it. So it's expensive to get a CAT scan.
Right, but if so many other people are using it, I mean, eventually it's going to be paid for. You know what I mean? If X amount... Not really. You know what I'm saying?
That's okay.
We have a million jobs.
Your questions are valid, so that's fine. Go ahead and ask them. I think the input here is that there's information that is out there, and I think the question is one that's saying it doesn't make sense to me, and I think there are probably other people that
Well, something like a CAT scan is an unusual procedure, something that's required a lot of scientific research as well as effort and highly paid scientists and putting things together. And I think that you have to recognize that it's going to be some years before the cost of it comes down in order to pay for all of these things. It's not an easy thing to do.
Back here.
To get these things, you just cannot, these things are sort of automatic to any person. No, not just an ordinary person thought up the CAT scan. It's just, and not just one person, but many, many over many, many years. And this has just evolved so that the time it'll probably be as common as an x-ray, but at the present time it just isn't. And I think that's true. You're talking about a heart transplant also. This is something that just a doctor can't just say, well, I think you need a heart transplant. I'll do it for you. This has got to be somebody who's just spent his whole life and all his thoughts, his energies, and everything is involved. So it's it has to be something very, very special. And just like the other gentleman said, you have to pay for these things, and we pay for it one way or another. And I said to myself, I'm sorry if I'm judgmental, but we're all talking about all of these agencies and these plans, but I don't think anybody has said anything about our own responsibility. And as a Christian retreat and a Christian group, I think we should consider that. What do I do for my neighbor? I mean, the simple thing is volunteering some time so that you, in a hospital that, or elsewhere. I happen to be a hospice volunteer. It goes into the homes. And it doesn't cost me anything for 4 hours so that I can relieve the primary caretaker. And this, in a very, very small sense, helps somebody. And I think that we can all think of that. I'm sorry if I sound minute and petty, but all these larger things we are considering all have their very, very foundation in the church's obligation for toward the sick. And of course, gradually the government took it over. And I realize I'm being idealistic because there are so many people somewhere along the line. We're going to have a large organization to take care of the many people. But let's examine ourselves too on a small scale. Let's not complain about everything that the government, that we ourselves have put in motion, is doing.
Okay, thank you. How about back there?
Well, I have a short and simplistic observation, partly as a home economist, partly as a practicing Christian, that I certainly support preventive medical care. It starts at home, it starts with every one of us. I support a good diet, and that's a very complicated subject, but I do support the woman upstairs who brought up that point and seemed to be talked in circles around and quite ignored and making her point. But if I, on the other hand, were a trained doctor, I would be so excited at using all the modern technology. I am fascinated by technology. I think I would find it very boring to tell people to drink more milk and all these things. I would just find it so much more exciting to be the best surgeon in the world and to lecture all around the world, as my own surgeon does, who gives me no advice at all on diet. Doctors are just human beings, and we're, as a lot of you have pointed out, we are dealing with it in one way or another.
Thank you. There was a comment back here, but...
Well, I was just going to throw a little bit of light on the cost thing.
Okay.
With the exams that I had this summer, one 45-minute magnetic resonance imaging was close to $1,000. And, I mean, it just boggles your mind when you think of those things. But that's just the way it is.
Hospitals get endowments to help pay for these CAT scans, too. A lot of hospitals are endowed by people leaving their legacy to the hospitals. So they shouldn't be charging so much for our CAT scan. It helps to pay for the equipment.
Well, one of the cost items also is research. There's many, many hours spent in research, especially in the drugs, in the actual medicine field itself, that I guess it's shocking the price of some drugs, especially heart medicines, that are required by patients. And that's where the prices really start to go up with the research in the medicines, the research in the technology. And sometimes, like, for instance, cancer has been worked on for years. And when the cure finally comes, if it is a medicine, it's going to be a very expensive medicine to pay for that time. You know, they're going to want their pound of flesh or whatever after, you know, when the time has come, you know, that they actually come up with the cure. And whether that's right or wrong, I don't know, but that is, I know, a great part of the cost also. It goes right back to
5 minutes. Anybody have?
Are you going to talk at all about the living will in the next 5 minutes?
I thought
that was one of the subjects we were going to get out.
You want to talk about the living will? I think. All right. Say something about it.
Well, I'm not going to talk about it myself, but I thought it was one of the factors we came to talk about this evening, about living and dying and the
living
will.
What are your thoughts about it?
Whether it's valid in certain states and is in other states. There are some hospital administrators there. Roger, would you like to comment on that?
Well, I really have no experience in that, except I heard, I wish I could think of his name, the medical ethicist for the University of Minnesota Medical School.
Art Kaplan.
Knows a bright Jewish boy. Spoke to us recently, and he's got good feeling for all this sort of thing. And he's not a lawyer, but he said the living will has no validity. That was his statement. And that it really is a situation that needs to be worked out between the doctor and his patient. If the patient is at the point where they can't communicate, then with the family. And that's been our experience. If you're our age, you've lived through that sort of thing and lived through that with your doctor, and it works fine. And his comment is, and that's why I've heard our 250 doctors talk about that sort of thing, and they work it out with the family. And without communications, it isn't going to work.
That's Minnesota. Other people have experience with that or thoughts about it, Sherry?
I recently took a philosophy course on death and dying. And the living will is one of the things we talked about. And basically, your autonomy goes out the window when you become terminally ill. And if you have a living will, that can be overrided by your most immediate family member. So that's really who it's left up to.
Thanks, Sherry. Bye-bye.
I had the experience that my husband had a living will.
Oh,
and I appreciated at the time that we knew his illness was terminal, our doctor approached us with the potential of indicating whether he wanted to be put on life-saving equipment, and he chose not to.
And that was a help to you, your
son? It was, definitely. And the next morning he kind of wondered about it, and rethought it, but decided that he had made the right overture.
And that's Iowa.
Right.
Okay. Anybody else have any experience with or thoughts about the living will?
I guess, you know, those are just helpful and letting people know how you feel about it, and hopefully it's made in a rational, when you're feeling rational. And so that input would be really appreciated by the person that has to make that decision.
I don't understand why they override it. If it's done legally and with your lawyer, why do the doctors think they have the alternative to make a different decision?
When you're a doctor and you have a family say, if you take my mother off the ventilator, I'll sue you, they're going to leave them on.
Yeah, the thing is, it's not a legally binding
document. It's not
document.
A legally binding document.
No. It's just like a...
It all depends on the state.
I worked it out with my daughter because my husband was on it and I knew he would have hated it. I had made the decision. I had four doctors come and tell me I did the right thing. And I went immediately to my lawyer and said, I want this in writing by you. My children have copies of it. I do not want life support as he had to have.
Mm-hmm. And it worked for you.
Well, I hope so.
Yourself.
Right.
Yes.
Okay.
Don,
you. I still think it's a matter of state, as far as whether a jurisdiction has been passed to make the living will effective and binding in the state. I don't know what Minnesota has, whether they have any state legislation on that.
I know that.
But in Florida, we do have it, and it is binding, and it can't be overridden.
Can people change their mind?
Of course. Individuals can always change their mind if they are of a
sound mind.
Okay.
In Minnesota, it goes to session every year and it never goes through. Back here.
When the hospice goes in to a terminally ill cancer patient home, the first thing they do is to present this DNR, do not resuscitate. Uh-huh. And it's always, if they do, and it's understood by the family, it's posted on the refrigerator. So if the patient dies while we're in attendance, we are instructed not to call 911, because within the state of Minnesota, you call 911, they are obligated to try to resuscitate.
And you're from Minnesota?
If you want to end on a note of humor, I can tell you a story. I came up here last year in the same discussion. Young fellow had tattooed on his chest, do not resuscitate, and out and rode on his motorcycle without a helmet, came back in and crashed, you know, and came in the hospital. As he was coming out of the coma, he was seen to try to rub it off his chest.
Lots of issues that we did not cover tonight. Obviously, this is a very complex and large issue, and I appreciate your willingness to share your ideas and your questions and to receive those from each other. I want to remind you that these forums are a time for open conversation and a chance to share with one another, and I appreciate your participation tonight. Have a good evening and a safe rest.